somebody asked me once, what's the best piece of advice you've ever had as a leader? And I said, well, I'm not sure, really, because there's loads of good advice out there. I know what the worst advice I ever had was. And it was when somebody said to me quite early on in my career, hurry up. And it was astounding the impact that that had on my mindset. And for years, 2 or 3 years probably, I was always in a hurry. Everything that I was leading or managing, it always had to be done in a hurry. And it took me some time to realize that pace is not hurry. Urgency is not necessarily hurry.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, folks. This is Ben Morton, and welcome to episode 35 of the show. In this episode, we are joined by John Mark Williams, who is the CEO of the Institute of Leadership and Management. John is a problem solver and strategist, working with senior leadership teams to help achieve effective delivery and competitive advantage. He was the architect of Santander's unique breakthrough program for fast growth SMEs and is the former CEO of the Agile Business Consortium. John was then appointed CEO of the Institute of Leadership and Management in September 2020. John has many years' experience in leadership development and international business and has lectured on strategy and international business at universities in the UK and Europe for over 2 decades. He occasionally writes about business for online publications as well. John is deeply curious about the leadership implications of business agility, predictive analytics, punctuated equilibrium, and artificial intelligence. In this episode, we explore how to adapt, flex, and change your leadership style as a result of working in different countries and different cultures, along with how COVID-19 is affecting leadership and management. And there was no way on earth I was going to have the CEO of the Institute of Leadership and Management on the show and not ask him about his thoughts on the difference between leading and managing and whether the age-old debate even matters at all. So, without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with John Mark Williams. John, a very warm welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you with us. First and foremost, how are you doing today?
Thank you very much indeed, Ben. It's absolutely great to be here. I'm doing pretty good today, actually. Thank you very much indeed. Looking forward to the future, as usual. I'm an eternal optimist, also my team always tell me. So I see no reason to deviate from that.
Yeah, good stuff. We were just saying before we hit record, weren't we, that kind of here in the UK, we're recording this just as we're getting ready for the next level of easing and kind of spring has arrived. So it does feel as though there's a lot to be positive and optimistic about, right?
I think that's absolutely right, yeah. And the coincidental timing of the loosening of the lockdown and the arrival of spring, it may be coincidental, but they do help to reinforce one another. Obviously, of course, we're not entirely sure yet what the future actually holds. Nevertheless, there are reasons to be optimistic and reasons to be hopeful. I always think there are reasons to be hopeful and potentially cheerful for the future.
Yeah, absolutely. John, so let's dive straight in with the questions. So could you start, please, by just telling us a little bit of the career journey that led you to becoming the CEO of the Institute of Leadership and Management, and perhaps 1, 2, 3, if you've got a third great one to share, some of the most significant, powerful leadership lessons you've learned along the way.
Yes, by all means, yeah. And I have to admit, my career, I've been a little bit of a nomad, I think, in my career. I've had lots and lots of different sorts of jobs. And I think that Probably my career has been characterized by two things. The first one is variety, and I have definitely been very, very privileged to have worked in a number of different countries, worked across a number of different sectors, everything from international trade and foreign direct investment to oil and gas, banking, logistics, civil service, higher education, a whole bunch of stuff, and for different types of organizations, private sector, public sector and not-for-profit. So variety has been a key platform, I think, really, of my career. As a result of that, the other thing which has characterized it is change. And really, it's produced my attitude to change, which is that I welcome and embrace it always. And I have to say, I would almost go as far as to say that I seek opportunities wherever change is necessary in order to be able to go in there and actually have a look at how it might be achieved. And I remember somebody saying to me once, it was quite funny, really, they said, look, you know, thanks very much indeed, John. You've done the job that we required you to do in this organization. What we need now is some continuity, you know, safe pair of hands, really. And we just had to agree that that isn't me, because I don't do continuity. I do change. I do catalyst pretty well. Once things are on an even keel, then actually you need to hit me on the head and put me in a sack and bundle me out of the door and get somebody else in, I think. So that variety and my attitude to change, my welcoming of change, have been the things that have really characterized my career. The two lines that have come out of it, therefore, have been international business. As I mentioned, I've been lucky to have worked in a number of different parts of the world, Middle East, Far East, North America, and across bits of Europe, and leadership development. And that's quite interesting, because the two have not really been divorced from one another. I started by doing international business, and the leadership development angle grew out of that when it started to become evident that doing business across countries and cultures and organizations actually does require a very broad approach to leadership and an understanding and willingness to accept that leadership isn't just a thing that can be specified and then sort of taught to people very easily and stuff like that. So I've spent quite a lot of time mentoring senior leaders individually or working with leadership teams, particularly over the course of the last 10 or 12 years, I think. Couple of lessons then. The first one is to reward results, not effort. And what I mean by that is when in a team, if I happen to occupy a sort of, I'll call it a leadership position, if you like, within a team, the key is for me to reward those behaviors and results rather than just people doing as much as possible. Because in the end, I believe that the core purpose of leadership is to achieve results that cannot be achieved any other way. We hear a lot, an awful lot, of course, about the softer side of leadership, especially at the moment, things like compassion and empowerment. And these are extraordinarily valuable elements to leadership. Yet they're all part of the how or the what rather than the purpose, the why. And the why of leadership is to produce the results. So for me, rewarding results rather than solely effort is very important. The other thing I'll say is, somebody asked me once, what's the best piece of advice you've ever had as a leader? And I said, well, I'm not sure, really, because there's loads of good advice out there. I know what the worst advice I ever had was. And it was when somebody said to me quite early on in my career, hurry up. And it was astounding the impact that that had on my mindset. And for years, 2 or 3 years probably, I was always in a hurry. Everything that I was leading or managing, it always had to be done in a hurry. And it took me some time to realize that pace is not hurry. Urgency is not necessarily hurry. Things have an optimal pace at which they can be achieved, and it's not necessarily in a hurry. So a couple of thoughts there that had quite profound impact on my approach to leadership.
That's amazing, John. And there's a couple of things straight away I want to dive in and ask you about, if that's okay. The first one is the last one, if that makes sense, which is your worst piece of leadership advice being around hurry up. Like, I think that's fascinating. I'd love just for you to expand on that a little in a minute, if you can, because one of the things I've been teaching, sharing with my clients over the past few years is to actually carve out time and be intentional about slowing down as a leader, like giving yourself time and space to stop and think. So yeah, I'd just love to hear a little bit more about kind of your thoughts on that and how that bad advice has almost evolved into good advice or a practice for you since.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, actually, this idea of slowing down, because I remember, and I'm sure many of your listeners will have seen this before, a great piece of advice I did get went about presenting to an audience. Because, of course, you know, we all do lots and lots of speaking and presenting and stuff like that. And one of the things that this tutor said to me was, write on your left hand, because I'm right-handed, write on your left hand the words slow down every time you make a presentation, because I wave my arms around a lot when I'm presenting and stuff like that. And they said, look, you'll be able to see this subliminally. Just write slow down, because whatever happens, you can almost never go wrong when you're communicating a message by slowing down a little bit. And I actually extrapolated that into just delivering leadership results, really, and getting away from this being in a hurry. The other thing is this, a very common phrase, actually, which arose, especially with the disruptive innovation movement and stuff like that, which is move fast and break things, which, of course, you know, it became a tenet of many of the online businesses and stuff. And I remember seeing an alternative to that recently, which was move fast and make things, rather than break things. And I thought that's the difference between hurry up and move at pace. Because hurry up has a sort of feel of, it doesn't really matter what happens as long as we're going quickly. Whereas, of course, that's not what leadership is about. If we're going to achieve results, we need to actually achieve the results we want to achieve. And the desired result is very rarely simply to get something done in a hurry.
I'm going to say, it's interesting, isn't it, John? Because so often phrases and strap lines like that, move fast and break things, it seems the whole sort of business world can suddenly grab hold of them, especially when we're in an age of kind of businesses popping up, growing quickly, kind of really innovating with technology. And we can apply that strap line to almost every aspect of leadership. But I think it's probably doesn't serve us well to just apply stuff universally, right? Because yeah, absolutely, there's times to move fast and make things. And there are other times as a leader, even if you're working in a highly innovative, evolving sector, where actually you still need to pause and take a bit longer to make a decision, whether that be 15 minutes in a board meeting or 2 minutes on the spot, or actually 4 weeks to do some due diligence before launching a new product or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely right. And nowadays, of course, some of this is driven by the business agility principles, which have grown up from the original agile methodologies, which were, I think, actually agile methodologies. The Agile Manifesto is 20 years old this year, and one of the principles of agility is that things are done. I will say more quickly, but more to the satisfaction of the customer, which is very often more quickly. I remember actually mentoring one chief exec. This was probably about 2 years ago, something like that. And I was having a chat with her, and she said to me, "Look, I don't know what to do next." And I said, "What do you mean you don't know what to do next?" She said, "I'm inundated with all these things telling me how I should be effective as a chief exec. Go global, do digital, be agile. I don't know what to do." I said, "Well, look, and this comes back to this idea of hurry up. One of the things that characterizes phraseology like that is urgency. You know, there's a momentum behind those phrases. Okay, that's fine. We can take on the meaning of the phrase. We can take on the urgency or the momentum. That doesn't mean to say we have to keep up with the people moving at the front edge. So we can choose. And one of the fundamental things required of a leader really is the capability of choosing between pace demanded by somebody else and the pace which is optimal for the team or the organization.
Building on that as well, I think one of the keys more and more for senior leaders is having processes or sort of mindsets in place that enable you to be able to say no to the right things. When you was telling that little story just then, I thought you was going down the road of kind of the chief exec just had too many opportunities. She didn't know which one to pursue, which more often is the case, right? There are very few businesses who struggle or fail because they have too few opportunities. It's often because they have too many and end up saying yes to too many things. So the focus and the effort gets diluted. So they aren't able to deliver those results that you mentioned, right? So I think the ability to say no, which perhaps that ability comes with being able to slow down occasionally to assess things is really key. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
I think that's absolutely right. And in actual fact, I would even use another current buzzword, I think, to describe that. And it's one of my favorites, which is mindfulness. I think mindful leadership does require us to be able to say, first of all, let's just slow down a minute and think. Secondly, let's decide from the global, digital and agile, which ones are relevant and appropriate for us right now in this context in our organization, because the exhortation to go global or do digital or be agile may be absolutely right for a whole bunch of organizations and not at all right for ours. And, you know, it's timing, things like context and stuff like that. I think also this idea of mindset, I remember talking to somebody once, and it happened to be about agility, because I was talking about agility, and I said, it originated as a methodology, then it became a mindset, then it became a cult. And actually, you know, and the same is true of globalization or digitization. They achieve this kind of cult status in the minds of leadership figures everywhere. And actually, it's a case of behavior more than anything else. I think it was Drucker who said entrepreneurship is a behavior pattern, not a character trait. And it's the same for, you know, globalization or digitization or agility. People are not born in this manner. How we behave determines whether or not we are agile. I could talk about business agility till the cows come home, as it happens, because I know a little bit about it. However, unless I behave in a manner that displays those characteristics, then I'm not really performing as an agile leader.
John, can I circle us back to something you mentioned when you was talking about your career journey, if I may? You said you'd done a lot of international, sort of global roles over the years. During that period, kind of, did you notice that you had to adjust your leadership style at all? I guess the question I'm really, really asking is, like, were there any significant changes kind of in terms of leadership dependent on where you're operating around the globe?
Absolutely, yes. And I think there are a number of dimensions to this, actually, because on the one hand, there are what most people would call cultural dimensions, which is that business behavior, organizational behavior, team behavior is different in different parts of the world. I suppose the most obvious thing would be things around time. For example, there are parts of the world, and many of us will know what they are, where turning up on time means something slightly different to turning up on time in the UK. You know, 5 minutes beforehand might be on time here. If one's working in an organization where turning up on time is about half an hour too early for most people, then it sounds trivial, yet it absolutely requires one to make some quite fundamental changes to how a leader approaches motivation and support and reward of a team, because the behaviors are different. Then, of course, we have cultures which are different in religious terms and all sorts of in-depth ways in which we have to adjust our individual behavior to suit the context in which we work. I use this word context an awful lot because I think we as human beings, we tend constantly to overestimate the importance of character and our individual characteristics and underestimate the importance of context. And I find it fascinating that organizations who move people around the world, to quite a large degree, actually, I still come across organizations who don't think it appropriate to prepare those people for the enormous challenge of operating in a different part of the world. And I think it's, you know, if we look at the cultural work that's been done by Hofstadter or Fontanar, there's a requirement, I think, for us to understand that people are individuals and cultures are individual too, and we need to alter our behavior dependent upon which culture we are with, in the same way as we would alter our behavior dependent upon whether we are having dinner at home with our parents or out having a social event with a bunch of friends or something like that. There was one striking example, actually. I did do a psychometric assessment, which I've done lots of, but I remember doing it when I was doing a particular type of job in higher education. And I got the result, and it was a Myers-Briggs type indicator, and I was ENTJ, I think I came out. And then I did it another time when I was involved in stockbroking and corporate finance. Now, I'm of the view, and always was of the view, that one's personality doesn't change. Actually, I came out as a slightly different type when I took it, when I was doing that role. I was ENTP, I think. And I remember asking the psychologist, I said, what's the difference here? And the response was, well, you care less what people think now.
Right.
I thought, oh, that's an absolutely obvious shift in my behavior, my response, if you like, to the culture in which I was working, because stockbroking was an unforgiving culture and didn't have time for, in a sense, mistakes, really. It punished mistakes, whereas the other one was a much more humanistic and much more social context and was very different.
I'm so pleased you shared that little story there, John, actually, because it's something that crops up a lot, isn't it? People do ask, like, does my personality, do my traits kind of change over time? And the question normally crops up when people are doing some sort of psychometric profiling. So it's fantastic data that supports the argument that I've often shared, that yes, if you suddenly put yourself in a very different context or culture, it will cause your behavior, personality to shift. So yeah, that's great. Thank you for sharing that. John, I don't think I can possibly have the CEO of the Institute of Leadership and Management on the show and not ask this question. I think if I didn't ask it, I'd be inundated with complaints. So seeing as both words are in the title, in your view or in the Institute's view, if they're slightly different, like, what is the difference between leadership and management? And does this eternal debate even matter?
Oh, it is the obvious question, I guess. And I'll have to give you an answer from me rather than from the Institute, because I'm not sure that there is a single definitive answer to this, really. However, my answer, and I'll give you a very embarrassing answer first, which is many years ago, I was being particularly, I suppose, arrogant, really, and decided that I understood the difference between leadership and management, and that I would pontificate at some public event that I was at. And I stood up to make a name for myself, and I said, management is a visible skill and leadership is an invisible talent. And I sat down immediately, enormously pleased with myself. And of course, everybody else in the audience sort of looked at each other and said, what does he even mean by that? But it was in my head, it was pretty obvious, really. Of course, it didn't mean anything to anybody else. I think that, I guess the difference is primarily the perception of management is that it is about functional operations, if you like, getting things done. Management is the hands-on engagement with a team or an organization to get stuff done, whereas leadership is often deemed to be more, I'll call it strategic, if you like, but it's more about revealing what should be done and helping or encouraging or motivating people to actually deliver it. So for me, there's a sort of arm's-length separation between, I'll call it operational competence. I don't mean that in any kind of derogatory sense, because, of course, people who can deliver things, which I can't, I am definitely leader, not manager, people who can deliver things are crucial to every organization. So that's what I would see as management, the ability to actually get stuff done. Leadership is the ability to reveal, I think, what needs to be done.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And John, how do you think the two manifest themselves and change throughout somebody's career, i.e. when you're doing maybe your first line manager job or first team leader job, in your view, are you there at that time doing much more management and a little bit of leadership, and then as you progress through an organizational hierarchy to MD or CEO? Do you then find yourself doing mostly leadership and a little bit of management, or is it kind of more 70-30? Just kind of, again, fascinated to get your view on how that shifts and changes.
Yes, and of course, very dangerously, I've already indicated a separation between the two, which means I now have to explain it, which is putting myself up. I think.
Sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
No, this is absolutely great. It serves me right for pontificating. You see, you don't have to explain what you mean. It's really interesting, actually, because there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that what we might think of as leadership competencies exists at every level of everybody's career and to varying degrees, partly because some of those competencies may not have been encouraged or practiced or had the opportunity to display themselves, partly because the context might actually not be there in which display of those competencies would be beneficial to the individual or the organization. I think early on in people's careers, I think people are getting used to the idea of getting stuff done, because that's what we're required to achieve in most jobs. We end up being given a task and we're expected to deliver that task. So our first approach to that is, how do I deliver this task? We then might move on, once we're comfortable with that, to thinking about, how is this task being delivered, rather than how do I do it? How effectively or efficiently is it being delivered? And then other ways in which I could improve the way that this is done. So then that's where the, if you like, the leadership, the seeing beyond the task to be done and revealing what ought to be done to oneself and then perhaps to one's team or to one's line manager or whatever. So leadership competencies can be displayed at any level by anyone, wherever it's appropriate. I think the shift comes in as we move through a career. I think most people will tend to move up the corporate ladder. And I'll use that analogy for the moment, although we see things differently now. Many people will tend to move up the corporate ladder as they go through their career, which means they move closer and closer to the idea of strategy from solely operational requirements. And the ability to think strategically is one of the competencies that leadership requires, which is the ability to think beyond the immediate requirements of the organization, look into the future, that sort of stuff. So I think whilst the two are separate is too strong a word. If we think of a coin, two sides to it, leadership on one side, management on the other side, or maybe there's a better analogy than that, but both of them are present in everybody. And people who are successful in their careers are those who can actually make, you know, the optimum decisions from time to time about which set of competencies to display, because there's no doubt if leaders forget or lose managerial competencies, i.e. they're getting stuff done, then actually they become ineffective as leaders as well. So there's a continuum, and we can operate anywhere on that continuum, wherever is appropriate.
John, quite a relevant and topical couple of questions now, if you don't mind. And these are, I guess, particularly hot off the press, really. I've been doing some research lately, sort of asking senior leaders what some of their biggest challenges or concerns are right now. And the two that really seem to be cropping up for people is, what do we do to effectively welcome and bring people back into our physical places of work in the future? For us in the UK, hopefully that might be kind of late summer or whatever. Other parts of the world might be slightly different. But that's one. Anything in particular, any advice you would give around that? And the second one is, lots of people saying, how do I lead and keep my team motivated and inspired when I'm feeling drained and tired myself? So just wonder, any thoughts you've got on those questions?
Yeah, sure. And I think I'll take them in that order, if I may. The first one around welcoming people back to their office or workplace, wherever that might be. The question mark in that becomes whether or not people want to be welcomed back.
Yeah.
because, you know, there's a big debate going on at the moment, of course, about, you know, whether everybody's going to want to stay working from home or they all want to rush back to the office and be able to socialize and all that sort of stuff, which is perfectly valid as a debate. One of the things which clouds that debate a little bit, I think, is that nobody has a clue how it feels to have the flexibility of work arrangements that we currently have in a normal marketplace. You know, because, you know, the year and a half that we've spent working from home or working from our cars or going in once every 3 weeks to the office or whatever it is, and indeed even those people who've had to go into their workplace every day, all of the context surrounding that is completely abnormal. So I think there's a, it'll be some time, even after the loosening of the economy is fully done, I think, before we see what kind of preferences the majority of people have for their workplace. I think one of the approach that I'm taking, I talk to my senior leadership team about this quite often, is that flexible working or hybrid working, however we call it, looks like being the optimal future for us, because we are very fortunate in that we're not a manufacturing business, for example. We don't need people to be in one place all at the same time. And yet we recognize that people are social animals. They do need to socialize sometimes. And allowing for flexibility, retaining the office, allowing for flexibility, people going in there with the reference requisite social distancing and other protections when they need to, is the opportunity that I think we will take. So without trying to predict or second guess how people will feel, giving people opportunity where it suits the organization to do so is one of the ways I think that we will get optimal results from people going back to work. And allowing for the fact that it will be another year before, as I say, before things settle down, before people even become themselves sure about what their preference might be. I think the second question, how does one lead and motivate and inspire people when one is feeling pretty tired oneself? It's funny, as I said earlier, right at the beginning, I think I'm a sort of eternal optimist. I have to say, after over a year of what we've been going through, even I, from time to time, start to feel a bit jaded and a bit sort of, I've had enough of this now, thanks very much indeed. Can we just go back to whatever normal's going to be and stuff like that? One of the greatest challenges of a leadership figure is the responsibility to be authentic and yet not to be demoralizing for one's team. Because sometimes authenticity means saying, I'm just sick of this, I can't go on with this any longer, I've had enough. That isn't what the team needs. And those of us who have, from time to time, actually felt like we've had enough and it's shown, have experienced exactly what kind of impact and effect that can have on our teams. If we are going to call ourselves leadership figures, then we need to recognize, actually, we need to avoid demoting of our team as much as possible. That doesn't mean that we can't let it be seen that we're tired too. I have several times said to my team in the past couple of months in particular, I know how you feel, because I do. I feel the same way too. And then it's our job to bring that conversation, whether with an individual or with the team, back to the motivational, supportive, and sometimes challenging things that will help people to feel better. It's not easy. Sadly, nobody ever said that leadership was going to be easy or even straightforward. That is our responsibility, though, I think, to ensure that however we feel, we actually maintain that momentum behind motivating and inspiring our teams. It's very difficult, but we need to do it.
Yeah, I love that, John. It's such a great way that you described it there. I think one of my favorite pieces of leadership research that exists, just because I think it's so robust, is the work done by Jim Kouzes and Barry Posner in the Leadership Challenge. And I think it's fascinating that I think 7 rounds of research they've done now over 30-odd years, the top 4 things that people say they look for in an admired leader have never changed. And amongst that top 4 has always been a leader who is inspiring. Now, my definition and a definition that kind of previous colleagues and I have always used for inspiring is about leaving everybody that you meet with more energy than when you met them. We always go on to say that's not about making everything kind of positive and putting positive spin on things, but it's just about being really conscious about your language, where you're putting your focus, the energy you're bringing. You can still be absolutely honest and authentic, right? But it is ultimately you've got to kind of lift people up. And as I say, that doesn't mean you can't face into the brutal truth, but you do it in a way that leaves people with more energy than when you met them.
I love that. That's such an elegant way to describe it, leaving people with more energy than when you met them. And I think in some ways, if somebody asked me for a definition of leadership, that's probably now what I would come up with, actually, because it just says everything, you know, and it means that we can, this idea of challenge and support, this matrix of challenge and support, actually, of course, it means that sometimes we will challenge people because actually, quite a lot of people like to be challenged as long as they feel that they can achieve that challenge. And that's where the support comes in. So if we can challenge and support people sufficiently for them to feel motivated, for them to have more energy than when we first started the conversation, absolutely, that's a great definition of leadership.
Yeah, and that's a great sweet spot when we can hit it, right? That challenge and inspiration, oh, yeah. when you hit that, that's where the magic happens, right?
It is, and I have to admit, I tend to be a bit of a rascal with this, actually, because my view, because I coach marathon runners as well in the past, and I tend to encourage people to do things that they are absolutely sure they cannot do. And this is where the challenge lies. At the same time, making it absolutely clear that I will support them every step of the way. Because I suspect that quite a lot of people would jump if they thought that they were going to fly or that they thought there was a parachute or a trampoline underneath. Most people will not jump if they think it's just a long drop and a concrete at the bottom of it, basically. So as long as they think they fly or that somebody will keep them up in the air, I think most people enjoy a challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. John, a couple of maybe quick fire questions to finish, if that's okay. What are the one or two books that have really had a significant impact on you as a leader, or perhaps even more generally in life?
Two very obvious ones, really, and one of them is Peter Drucker, which is Innovation and Entrepreneurship. And I read a copy of this that I got from a jumble sale many years ago, and it just blew me away completely. And the clarity of the descriptors around what innovation is and what entrepreneurship is really, really did me a power of good. The other one actually is by Henry Hazlitt, and it's Economics in One Lesson. And I rail all the time about the fact that most people seem to have no basic understanding of economics. And I think leadership figures absolutely need to have this. And Hazlitt's book is just remarkably clear, concise, and wonderfully explanatory of economics and principles. So that would be the two I would choose, I think.
I'll be going off to order that second one straight away. And final question, John, do you have any particular routines, ways of working that are particularly effective for you, help you play at your best, help you manage your energy? Because that's one thing listeners are always fascinated in, like the little strange, quirky, different or normal, not non-quirky routines that kind of senior leaders kind of use and have to help them do what they do.
Yeah, I tend to start early because I wake up early, but that's not because, you know, leaders always start at 4 a.m. or anything like that. It's very rare that I actually wake up at 4 a.m. However, I start early because I just start when I wake up, really. The important thing for me is lots of breaks. Micro breaks, I think they're called now. Lots and lots of breaks. I'll get up and walk around every 15 or 20 minutes. Get up and walk around and just for 4 or 5 minutes, go outside, look out the window. Sometimes I'll just stop when I'm working, have a look out the window, have a think for a while, make a cup of tea or whatever it is. It's the point is that even on an intense project, a work day is a marathon, not a sprint. Even one day is a marathon, not a sprint. And we need to take breaks in order to keep our attention actually focused. So I would say take lots of little breaks.
Yeah, it's amazing. As you're saying that, I was just reflecting on the past 12 months or so, and it's felt like kind of running sort of 52 ultra marathons, one a week, right? So I think the, yeah, in the micro breaks, macro breaks, whatever you're calling them, just lots of breaks, absolutely. And is that something you have always done, or is that a sort of new habit you realized would be helpful at some point in your career and decided you wanted to install?
It actually is something I've acquired probably over the last 10 years or so. It took me a few years to get over the hurry up, first of all, which didn't allow for any breaks, of course. And then even when I'd got over that, I was working at what I thought was a sensible pace and still not utilizing the breaks. And it was actually coaching other people, coaching runners and stuff like that, that made me realize, you know, the body doesn't improve when it's training. It improves when it's resting. And the same is true of the mind.
Absolutely. John, I'm very conscious of your time and indeed listeners' time. So with that in mind, I think we'll call it time there for today. But I just want to say a huge thank you for your time today. I've thoroughly enjoyed chatting with you. And I just think there's so much that you have shared that's going to be so, so valuable to everybody listening. Before we wrap up, final question is, if people want to find out more, connect with you, then what's the best way to do that?
The best way is always LinkedIn. And if they look for John Mark Williams on LinkedIn, they'll find me there.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, John. Have a great day, whatever you're going on to do next.
Thank you very much indeed, Ben. It's been delightful chatting.
I hope you found that conversation valuable, folks, but most importantly, I really hope that you're able to go away and make some small positive changes as a result. If you did get value from this episode, then please do rate, review and subscribe via iTunes, as it really does enable us to keep bringing you more and more interviews with fantastic leaders and subject matter experts. Do also visit ben-morton.com, where you can connect with me, find out more about my leadership mentoring and team development work, along with details of all of my online programs via the tools and resources page. That's it for this episode. See you again in the next one very soon, and lead on.